It's roughly midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, call it. And, you know, of course I'm saying, you know, kissing the kids and, you know, telling them I love them and doing all the things that you do beforehand. And I remember my oldest daughter, she had to get a picture with me, right? And she's always been like my biggest cheerleader and stuff. And she was a firefighter, by the way. And so we get a picture in front of the mantle, and I saw that picture the other day, and just the emotions of that moment kind of hit me again, because I remember standing there and in my mind going, you don't have to go. And I knew I didn't have to, right? But I did have to, right? I mean, these were my brothers and I was going to go.
In this inspiring episode, we sit down with Colonel Nick Nichols, president of Folds of Honor, a nonprofit organization that provides educational scholarships to the families of fallen and disabled service members. Colonel Nichols shares his life in a military family growing up and talks about his journey from military service to leading the impactful mission, offering insights into the power of education to transform lives and honor sacrifice. From the history and growth of Folds of Honor to exploring compelling stories of the families they've helped, we'll discuss the importance of giving back to those who have given so much for our country. It's a testament to the resilience of military families and the extraordinary ways communities can come together to support them. Service, legacy, family, and the impact of Folds of Honor's work, whether you're a veteran, a military family member, or someone looking to make a difference, it's a conversation that makes an impact at many levels. Welcome to the Winchester Life Podcast. I'm your host, Jason Brown. Welcome to the Winchester Life Podcast. Through insider access to industry pioneers, firsthand looks at cutting-edge tech advancements, and the stories behind the scenes that have shaped the world of shooting sports and hunting as we know it, we'll dive into the sacred places like deer camps and duck blinds, talk about innovation and shooting tips with the world's best, while revisiting age-old traditions of hunting and shooting still alive in our country. I'm your host, Jason Brown, and welcome to the show. The Winchester Life Podcast is brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, Winchester Repeating Arms, Winchester Safes, White Flyer Targets, Folds of Honor, Birchwood Casey, Walkers, Winchester Pet, and Winchester Optics. Colonel Nick Nichols, Folds of Honor, man, president of this great organization, man, thank you so much for taking time today to stop out and chat a little bit on the Winchester Life Podcast with me.
Yeah, Jason, it is so good to be with you guys. Love everything about what you guys are doing, and love me some Winchester.
Yeah, the American legend, man. The American legend.
It is.
You know, so Folds of Honor, personally, I've kind of followed it for years, and it hits close to home mainly because of what you stand for, obviously, but the event you guys have here in Michigan. The golf event is something that I'm a huge golfer and I love, actually absolutely love that event. It's unlike anything else, and we'll get into that down the road, but yeah, I appreciate everything you guys do, and I'm looking forward to learning a lot more about you and, you know, kind of your upbringing and your career in the military and how it transitioned into the president of this incredible organization. So taking it way back, talk a little bit about, you know, tell me about your upbringing. Where were you raised and kind of what was your family dynamic?
Yeah, so I was raised, I'm a military brat, so I'm an Air Force kid. So I was born at Moody Air Force Base in Valdosta, Georgia, which is ironically where I ended up going back to college. And so I kind of went back to my roots when I went to college. But yeah, I was, you know, born. My dad, a year later, went to Vietnam. I was raised by a fighter pilot, so I'm a second generation in the business, which is super cool. So we lived that military life kid, or military kid life kind of thing. So moving quite a bit, making new friends every 2 to 3 years. You can never really get, you know, entrenched into a sports team or anything like that. But it was, you know, it was a cool life. Got to live in some cool places and stuff like that. And, you know, it was a obviously a neat time frame in my life.
So you guys bounced around a little bit. What are some of the cities you guys lived in growing up?
Oh, my goodness. We were in Fort Walton Beach, Florida. We lived in D.C. We lived in Kansas. Obviously, I've mentioned Georgia, Moody Air Force Base. And then my dad's last duty station was actually, we're in Cairo, Egypt, if you can believe that. So wow. I lived there as a kid.
Jeez.
As well. Yep.
What do you remember about Cairo?
So Cairo, you know, it's so funny. So this would have been back in like the early 80s. And we're talking like the time frame like right after the Sadat assassination and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So it's probably not people's mental expectation of what, you know, that side of the world is like now. It was neat. I mean, I can remember going out. We lived in a little town called Mahdi, which is just outside Cairo. And going to the Giza pyramids and riding Arabian horses through the desert. Wow. And stuff like that. So it was super, super cool. I mean, and you know, another really neat part of this story is that at 15 years old, that is where I met my wife. Now, obviously, we weren't married when I was 15 years old, but we reconnected a few years later when we were both in college. And Steph just celebrated our 35th anniversary. So that's one awesome thing that happened out of it. And you talk about, you know, my background and stuff like that. And part of my why at the Folds of Honor is, you know, at 15 years old, I was one of those kids who got that knock on the door, right? So my dad had been killed in a tragic accident. And here we are in a foreign country and really not knowing what to do and you know, just kind of thinking about what the next, you know, day and week are going to look like in our lives and stuff like that, and trying to repackage everything and, you know, put the family back together. So that understanding makes me, you know, get up each and every day and make sure I'm fighting for the same kids who were in the same situation I was.
Yeah. I mean, how do you pick things up at that point? I mean, you get the knock and obviously it's a shock. What's the next step after something like that?
You know, it's really weird. You know, grief is a weird process. And in during those time frames and other people who have experienced trauma like that, you have like really, really vivid memories of it, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you can almost remember every sound, every smell, time of day, all those type of things. And I remember initially it was just like just wanting to get back to the States, right? Get back, you know, to our people, our grandparents and stuff like that. And I remember that being the longest plane ride home like ever. Yeah. Right. And because, you know, what do you talk about, you know, on the plane? And I know that, like, the next step for us, you kind of want a little bit of closure, like, you know, what happened and those type of things. But at the end of the day, you know, my dad wasn't coming home. So what's next? And for us, what was next is to make sure that my dad had a proper burial, right? And so he was an Air Force Academy grad, 1966 grad, and obviously a Vietnam War hero, two tours in Vietnam, you know, Purple Heart, Silver Star, just a very distinguished flying career. And the odd thing is that until the funeral, I never cried, but I hadn't shed one tear yet. I felt anger, you know, I was very angry, as you can imagine a 15-year-old kid would be. And I'm the oldest of three. And so you're taking on a little bit of a heavy load as the oldest sibling in the household. But I remember, you know, being on the grounds at the Air Force Academy and, you know, going through the services and, you know, a four-ship of F-4s comes over and does a missing man formation. So that's where the number three in the formation goes straight up. Then a four-ship of F-16s do the same thing. Mm-hmm. And then shortly after that, TAPS plays. That's when I lost it.
Yeah. Right?
Because there's just something about TAPS. There's just like some it's extraordinarily reverent, but there's some finality to it, right?
Yeah.
And it just hit me all at one time. At that point, and then that's when you start asking yourself the questions like, you know, what are we going to do?
Right.
You know, where are we going to live? What's going to happen to us and stuff? And that is when reality really sinks in.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think obviously your military upbringing played a huge role in your career because that's the path you took, right? What were the steps for you to say, okay, this is what I love? I lost my father when I was 15, and he was part of the military at the time. But even though that happened, you didn't have, you know, it wasn't negative enough. You wanted to commit yourself to the military. Talk about just the, you know, the first part of that decision.
Yeah. So I think for me, like, you know, you go from, you know, my dad's funeral and we end up back in, you know, back in Georgia.
Yeah.
Going to high school and stuff like that. And I wanted to be a fighter pilot ever since I could remember. Right. I mean, that's what I was going to go and do, and never had a plan B in life. It was that or nothing. But you sort of lose sight of that. You know, I was a kid, right? Yeah. High school, all the other things that high school kids get involved in and stuff. And ended up applying for and going to Valdosta State University right there in my town. And didn't have a really good first semester of college, right? You know, you start finding out things like beer and girls and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And your priorities kind of shift. And JB, man, I just had this, all I can say, of just a big time God moment for me. It was in between my semesters, my freshman year, and just this daunting guilt of like, your dad would not be proud of you right now, mm-hmm. right? And get back to what you know how to do, get back to what you want to do. And man, I made a commitment that very day, cultivated a lot of morning disciplines that I still utilize today, and just put the pedal to the metal, man, and never looked back.
Yeah,
and man. Stuff. And really everything, I mean, I had everything against me, right? To go make this happen, because, you know, a lot of guys want to go be a fighter pilot and stuff. I mean, but you got to like really, really want it and stuff, because your odds of making it from the guys who start to the guys who finally pop out at the other end and are able to make that a career is 5.4%. So the odds are not wow. in your favor,
yeah.
right? And stuff. And, you know, the best, you know, advice that I gave myself was just always drown out the negative noise. You know, if I would have listened to the dozens of people who told me, you know, you'll never do that, that can't happen, it, you know, all those things, you just drown that out.
Drown
and
out.
I knew in my heart, this was what God made me to do.
Yeah. It's what he made you to do, man. And, you know, there's a lot of firsts in the military. I mean, there is in life in general, but when you're in the military, I feel like it's those moments, that kind of stick in your mind when you first do certain things as you progress and get skills and you become a fighter pilot. But there's a first time you're in a jet and that first time you fly it. Take us through that.
Oh, yeah. So, you know, I'll back the story up just a little bit, just to provide a little bit of context.
Perfect.
And then go into it.
Yeah.
So, you know, the first stage in training is pilot training, right? It's undergraduate pilot training. So that's just the basics, right? And that's 13 months long, right? And so I was stationed at Shepherd Air Force Base in Wichita Falls, Texas. My wife and I just got married. And I remember we showed up on the first, it was like the first evening, everybody was in town, right?
Yeah.
And stuff. And you're meeting all these guys and I'm meeting all these guys and like, hey, where'd you go to school? Well, you know, I just finished up my master's degree at MIT and somebody else just, you know, I just graduated, you know, with my master's from Vanderbilt and, you know, and X amount of thousands of flying hours and stuff like that. And I remember going home and talking to my wife, I go, I don't think I'm supposed to be here. I think they let me in by accident.
That's crazy.
But it reinforced in my brain, right? You know what? In life, man, you're always going to come across people who are smarter than you,
yeah.
who have more experience than you. But the one thing that I could always control is you will not outwork me.
Yeah.
Okay. Period. And so, leading up to your question, you know, a lot of time and effort and everything goes up before you ever step foot in that jet. But the first time you're cranking those motors and you're in that jet by yourself, it is surreal, man. I mean, it is like, it's a combination of religious and a rock and roll concert at the same time,
man.
Right? You just have all the emotions bouncing off of both both stops, and it was incredible. And still to this day, the greatest smell in the world is the smell of a flight line, man. I mean, it just smells like freedom, brother.
Yeah, it's so man. Cool. Yeah, I was just thinking that I tie my freedom to bush pilots and bush crafts and going deep into the bush up in Alaska and the Yukon and smelling that jet A fuel on the tarmac and walking up into that little ass cockpit and putting on those and me with a camera in hand documenting the whole thing with maybe a little Xanax and maybe a little stuff to keep my equilibrium straight. Don't love the movement, but I love the adventure. But yeah, it's crazy. And when you talk about that, it's a full on, it's an experience with the senses, the smell, the what you see, what you feel, the feedback. So when you take off, is it just you or do you have a co-pilot with you, or how's that first flight? How's that shaping out?
Yeah. Okay. So the very first flight, you're always with an instructor, right?
Right.
So in pilot training back in the day, we started out in the T-37, which is a little, side by side, you sit next to each other, jet and stuff like that. But man, it was still a jet, right?
Yeah.
Super cool. And you didn't have to go, do aileron rolls and loops and all the things that, a jet can do and
yeah.
stuff. And so it's not quite as impactful, still cool.
Yeah.
But when you're in that for the first time by yourself and there's nobody else, nobody to help you, you're mm-hmm. it, right? If something goes wrong, you got to handle it
yeah.
and stuff. That's when it gets super real.
Yeah, it's fun. I don't know, but this algorithm in Instagram finds me. And for some reason, I must have started watching some airplane and pilot stuff and some landings and students flying. And just yesterday, popped in. It was a 16-year-old kid, first time he soloed. And it had a GoPro in there the whole time, and it kind of showed his flight path. It was, I don't know, maybe a 3 or 4 mile loop, and he came back and landed. And when he landed, it was just like, I did it. 16 years old, the instructor hopped in the side with him and said, you did a great job. And I can't imagine that. I can't imagine going up for the first time as a 16-year-old kid or anybody in being able to accomplish that solo flight up and back. And I know the training's insane to get you to that level. But when you finally accomplish these things, you must just be going home that day just on cloud nine.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, pilot training is a combination of your, like emotions that you hit off of every stop, right? Because
yeah.
not every day is a good day, but those days, yeah, you go home. And of course, I want to tell my wife, Carrie, all about it and everything that was going on. It was super, super cool. And just that, strong, emotional attachment that, that a fighter pilot has to his craft and, to the air and the environment and all those, type of things. But that's just one step in the road, right?
I mean,
this was, that pilot training year, that first year, man, that's just 1 year in a 3-year journey,
right?
To get combat qualified. So that, each day is a new adventure and a new challenge and stuff. And yeah, you want to rejoice in the moment, but as soon as you're done with a quick rejoicing, get back to the books because
yeah.
the next thing's coming.
Yeah. So the next thing, obviously the goal is to be combat ready, to be combat trained.
Yep.
You've done missions. Is there a mission when you think about one that kind of stands out? Maybe it was a unique location. Maybe it was I'm sure stump stuff might be classified. Who knows? But is there something you can tell me about that a mission that you can look back on and say, wow, that was a wild one?
Yeah, there was a lot. I was fortunate enough, and it may sound weird to your audience, but you become a fighter pilot because you want to go fight, right? And that's your job. So ended up with 6 tours in Iraq and 1 in Afghanistan. Mm. And I'll go back to like my very first combat deployment and talk about kind of what I saw there, and then I'll fast forward to my last combat deployment for more of a relevant story. But I remember that first combat deployment leaving, I was actually stationed in Japan. Okay. So I'm there with my, I'm what, 26, 27 years old. a very young wife and a two-year-old and a newborn, right? And so we get called up and we are going to deploy as part of Operation Southern Watch, which is the southern half of Iraq. And this is post the first Gulf War.
Okay.
And I remember you're so fired up as a young fighter pilot, right? You are just like full of piss and vinegar, man. And you're just like, oh, this, like you're Hollywooding it in your head,
yeah.
Right? And I can remember while we were en route, and some of your listeners may remember this, if they don't, they can look it up. It was the base that we were going to, we were actually gonna stage out of Saudi Arabia, and the Khobar Tower bombing happened, a terrorist hit. And 19 Americans lost their lives that day. We arrived in theater very shortly after that. And of course, you know, I wanted to go see where it happened, right? These were my brothers and sisters who had paid the ultimate sacrifice. And it never really hit me the finality of it in terms of the ultimate sacrifice, folks going to war. As I'm walking over there, you start looking down on the concrete and there was bloody footprints. Mm-hmm. And like, man, yeah, that is American blood on foreign soil.
Yeah.
Right. That was a big deal. So that was a little bit of a sobering moment for me, you know, as a fighter pilot, you know what, this is not about me. Okay. This is about being a part of something much, much bigger than myself. And you take that. And so that was in 1996, somewhere around in there. Mm-hmm. So now fast forward 17 years, okay? 17 years, I go on my final combat deployment. By the way, number six combat deployment was supposed to be the last. I fortunately have a wife who is amazingly patient, and when I came home and told her that I volunteered to go back for the seventh, yeah. She was obviously very, very supportive and stuff. But at the time, now I've got teenagers,
yeah.
Okay, and stuff. So it's a totally different dynamic going over there. And I can remember the night I left. You know, in the military, you never leave at convenient times, right? It's not like 10 o'clock in the morning. So we were taking off in 8 F-16s. We're going to take off and fly over to Afghanistan, and we're taking off at 2 o'clock in the morning, right? So I'm saying goodbye to my family. It's roughly midnight, 1 o'clock in the morning, call it. And, you know, of course I'm saying, you know, kissing the kids and, you know, telling them I love them and doing all the things that you do beforehand. And I remember my oldest daughter, she had to get a picture with me, mm-hmm. right? And she's always been like my biggest cheerleader,
yeah.
and stuff. And she was a firefighter, by the way. Mm-hmm. And so we get a picture in front of the mantle, and I saw that picture the other day, and just the emotions of that moment kind of hit me again,
yeah.
because I remember standing there and in my mind going, you don't have to go. And I knew I didn't have to, right? Yeah. But I did have to, right? I mean, these were my brothers and I was gonna go. And I remember walking out to my truck and throwing my bags in the back of the truck and jumped in and just sat there kind of gripping the steering wheel for a second and just kind of dealing with this overwhelming sense of guilt on one side for leaving your family,
yeah.
and this overwhelming sense of duty knowing that I needed to go, right?
Yeah.
But in that moment right there, brother, you got to shut that stuff off,
yeah.
right? You just got to go boom. And this may sound harsh to some people, but you almost have to divorce yourself of your family,
yeah.
okay, mentally, right? I can't be back home in my mind and go fight a war.
Yep.
I got to go.
Yep.
So I did. And, you know, we make it to Afghanistan. And, you know, like I said, this was the 2013 time frame. And you get back in theater and, you know, having, you know, been in similar circumstances six times before, you get out, you get, you know, the smells are familiar, the sounds are familiar, and you get rocking and rolling, man. And I can remember, man, this is day one. And I'm one of the older guys in the squadron, so I'm an instructor pilot and a flight lead and all those other things. And I've got this really young wingman mm-hmm. with me, solid kid and stuff like that, but he's new, first combat sortie, right? So we take off and we're operating out in the Helmand province, which is west of Kandahar, which is where we are based out of. And as we take off, we go and we check in with the JTAC. And for those of you who don't know, JTAC is a Joint Terminal Attack Control. They're the guys on the ground embedded. We're operating with Special Forces guys this day, embedded with them on the ground. And they're the ones who call in airstrikes. Mm-hmm. Okay, so they tell me, hey, enemy's over here. You're cleared hot to drop a bomb, whatever it might be. So this mission was strictly to be overwatch, yep. Right? So I'm thinking, okay, this is great. You know, we check into the op. The call sign for the JTAC is Widow, W-I-D-O-W, 1. And as we check in with him, you know, we survey the area, we get eyes on friendlies, and just, you know, checking the area for anything that they would call suspicious. Well, during that time frame, my wingman's getting low on gas. So I clear him off to go to the tanker to air refuel, and I stay on station. We always left somebody on station. We never left guys on the ground alone. And as soon as he left and checked off a frequency, I look down in on my screen, and what I'm looking at is it's a targeting pod, right? So, you know, for your viewers out there, just think of something that's a zoom camera zooming in on the ground, and that's what we use to drop our weapons off of, right?
Yep.
So I'm looking in this building that this team is holed up in, and the next thing I see is two rocket-propelled grenades hit the building. Mm-hmm. One, not from the same direction either, mm-hmm. right? One hits one side, one hits the other side of the building, and obviously the radios start going crazy at that point. And so it's a little bit of an urban area,
yeah.
So I can't see where it came from. I just know the direction that I can see the direction that it came from, but I can't see exactly where. So I can't get my eyes on anyone. And, you know, Widow One obviously hits the radio. I let him know I see what's going on. So he and I are working back and forth, and I'm trying to ID where these guys are at. Every time he would key the mic, okay, you would hear rapid gunfire. You know, you'd hear gunfire hitting the building.
Yeah.
You would hear gunfire, you know, being returned. And that type of stuff. And this goes on for quite a while. And then at some point during this whole attack, Widow One comes back and lets me know that they have two KIA. Okay. So we just lost two Eagles, mm-hmm. you know, killed in action. Mm. And so this is going from an overwatch, okay, to troops in contact to now this is going to be a rescue mission.
Yep.
And well, I know I need to get helicopters in there, but we cannot find these guys, all right? So the one thing a fighter pilot can do when you can't get clearance to drop and you can't find the enemy, obviously you don't want to go spraying bombs down there and cause anything to happen
yeah.
to the guys that you're protecting, right? That would be the worst case scenario. So what I do is I drop down from about 20,000 feet to 500 feet, light the afterburner, start making a lot of noise, okay, and we just let the enemy know that this fight is no longer fair.
Yep.
Okay, and we're prepared to bring a whole lot of hate to the fight and stuff, and it ceases the fire long enough that we can start getting calls out and stuff like that, and responsibly get helos into the area so they can exfil the wounded in the KIA. As I'm talking to Widow One, I notice his breathing getting labored, right? As he's mm-hmm. Keying the mic, he's a little bit slow on comms. And, you know, the last thing that he told me is, you know, Widow One copies. And as I could hear his voice, and he never answered back.
Yeah.
So he died while I was talking to him on the radio.
Yeah.
I mean, right there. And man, that in the moment, you know, with the adrenaline going and stuff like that, you don't process it, right?
Yeah.
You're just like, I need to get these guys out of there. And we do. They get them home, you know, with three guys that day and stuff. And, you know, so you're just kind of constantly evaluating in your mind, you know, what could I have done to be better, faster, find them, do all the things. And at the end of the day, you know, you just have to resign yourself to the fact that, man, sometimes it's just war.
Sometimes
you can't fix it.
Not in your control all the time. Yeah.
It's not in your control all the time, right? And so to put things into perspective, that was hour one, day one, okay, of months of deployment, right? Yeah. And that was every day. And you know, that was that day alone was an, that was an 8 hour mission. That was just our first op.
Yeah.
You know, we probably hit 8 to 10 others that same day.
And that was number 7. That's the one that you didn't necessarily have to go back. No, was that number 6, right?
No, that was number 7.
That was number 7.
That was the last one. Did not have to go. Yeah, did not have to go.
Yeah.
And, but it's just one of those things that, you know, you just, people have been in my shoes, they get it.
Right. Yeah.
And they'll go, I get it.
Well, I think in the only way I can experience a lot of this stuff is I do have some family members who've served in the military. But it's through films and you see that, you see like Chris Kyle and the American Sniper. I know that's based on a true story, but he couldn't leave his boys. You know, he had to keep going back and back and back. It was just, and they did a nice job kind of showing the decision-making where, like you said, you almost have to separate your family from your decision when you're out there. And I can't, this is not even close to what you guys do. But when we do a show called Dropped, and I produce it and direct it, and we go out in the middle of the bush for a month, and we don't take food with us. We hunt and fish and, you know, live off the land. But when we fly in there, stuff happens. Anything can happen when you're up there in the middle of nowhere. So, you know, every time you do say goodbye to your family before you go out there for a month and you know, you live in the wilderness off the grid, there is a level of this could be it. You never know. It could be it any day. But when you put yourself in a situation where the percentage of your survival is way lower than driving to work, things are different and things hit you different. So I understand what you're talking about, but I don't understand if that makes sense. The what you guys do every day and you know, we can all be so thankful for, and we don't even know what you guys do most of the time. And I think that's the thing that why we should be the most thankful. There was a series. Did you watch Masters of Air on Apple Plus?
I did.
Yeah. I did. So when you talk about those missions and what those, I mean, it was a death sentence to be in that, with those boys over there. Where were they stationed? Do you remember? I feel like it might have been Germany.
I think they were stationed out of England.
England, I think you're right.
Yeah, flying ops into Germany and stuff. And like, yeah, as far as the level of danger and stuff like that, I mean, what I did is nowhere in comparison to what those guys were going through. I mean, those guys, I mean, you talk about having a gigantic set, man. I mean, they were amazing.
Unreal.
And stuff. And like literally every single day, just sitting there counting airplanes coming home and just trying to figure out, you know, if guys made it or they wouldn't, and their odds of survival were so low in
so
those intense flight environments. It was just unbelievable. We talk about, you know, heroism to the next level. That's it.
That's it. That's it, man. So, I mean, one, thank you for your service and everybody who served with you. But you retire, and then Folds of Honor kind of drops into your life. How'd that all transpire?
You know, it's a really, really cool story. So our CEO and founder, Lieutenant Colonel Dan Rooney, he and I met over 20 years ago, probably 25 years ago now. And he was a young fighter pilot coming into the squadron. That's how we met. In fact, he flew his very first combat sortie on my wing, which is, you know, kind of a neat data point and history point for both of us. But I remember it would have been around the 2006 timeframe, Dan talking to me. And this is before Folds of Honor even really got going.
Yeah.
And he was talking about his passion to go do this. And he knew my background with my dad and stuff like that. And wanted to get my thoughts. And I'm like, brother, that is amazing. Go for it. Okay. And I'm thinking 2006, I am not thinking about retirement at the time.
Yep.
I didn't retire till 12 years later. And Dan and I had kept in touch, you know, through the years and stuff. He was busy, I was busy, life goes on. But man, we really connected on the center point, Folds of Honor. And and he goes, why don't you come work for me? And I'm like, okay. And for me, the next chapter in my life is really weird after 30 years coming out of uniform and waking up the next day. And I can remember it was this combination of, oh, this is what it feels like to not be stressed out all the time. Mm-hmm. And the other side of it too was just this sense of, what the hell do I do now?
Yeah.
Right. Like, what is civilians even wear? And stuff. But it gave me an opportunity to continue to serve, right? You know, it may not be in the uniform anywhere, but man, I proudly display this folded flag, you know, here on my hat wherever I go. And that has created new opportunity for me to give back, you know, to these amazing families and stuff, you know, because, you know, from my perspective, the way I look at it, you know, I've been married 35 years. I got three amazing kids, okay, who are all graduated from college and all doing great. My wife and I were able to buy property about 3 years ago, and we built ourselves a ranch out here. Then, you know, I could just get out and go jump in my Polaris and go deer hunting on my property and stuff. So I'm super thankful for that.
But and you're in Oklahoma?
Yeah, in Oklahoma.
Yeah.
But in all of that, I mean, the main thing that gets me up each and every day is, Lord, don't ever let me take for granted that I got to come home.
Right.
That's it. I mean, that resonates with me. And like I said before, in the fuel that fires me all the time is making sure that these kids are taken care of. That's it.
Yeah. And so that kind of leads me into the mission. You know, what is your mission at Folds of Honor?
Yes, at Folds of Honor, we provide educational scholarships to the spouses and kids of both military members and first responders who have either been killed or disabled. You know, an interesting data point here is that, you know, since inception, since 2007, so 17 years, we have provided 62,000 scholarships, nearly $300 million out the door, which is unbelievable, you know. And my dear friend, you know, Colonel Rooney, you know, starting this above his garage in Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, he and his wife, you know, I've asked him, I said, could you have ever imagined that this is where this organization would be? And he would quickly remind us that, you know what, God is bigger than our dreams.
Yeah.
Period. And it has been an honor to be a part of this. I've been here for 6.5 years now, and to see the organization grow the way it has is just been an unbelievable experience.
Yeah, it's crazy what you guys are now involved in, and how large you've grown, and the respect that you guys have. So if a family needs you guys to help out, like, what, how's that work?
Yeah, so if you go to our website at boldsofhonor.org, in fact, right now our scholarship application window is open, okay? So if you're military, veteran, first responder, former first responder, go check us out and see if you qualify. That's step one, okay? Step two is fill out the application, right? And we've got an unbelievable scholarship team that'll walk you through the entire process, help you as much as you need. And so we can make sure that we get, you know, the scholarship money to the right people.
Yeah. So Winchester has been a huge part of some of the initiatives. How's that? How's a sponsor? How's Winchester helping you guys out specifically?
Well, I mean, just think of the name Winchester, right? You thought that everybody in this country knows the name Winchester, right? Whether you own a gun or not, you know Winchester. You talk about winning the Wild West, whatever it might be, you're talking about hunting, you're thinking of Winchester. I mean, it is an iconic American brand, right? Yeah. Just absolutely unbelievable. Yes, there is tens of thousands of dollars in financial support that comes from Winchester, which is unbelievable. But us having the privilege of being associated with a brand like that, I mean, are you kidding me? I mean, it's unbelievable, you know, and we have been very fortunate, you know, with several brand partners to have that type of collaboration with them and stuff, right? I mean, look, I mean, I'm on the podcast right now. Yeah. I got to go hunting with these guys this past year and stuff like that. I mean, there are so many, the relationship goes beyond money, right?
Yeah.
And when somebody like Winchester is willing to share their brand with us and vice versa, man, that's the best compliment we can get. You know, who knows where this goes, right? Who knows, just somebody listening to this podcast, right? Hopefully it'll change their life in some way. They'll go donate, or man, it's somebody who needs our support.
Absolutely. And we're so proud to be associated with you guys. I mean, it's one of those things that, you know, it's one of the first things that I talk about. When you talk about what are the conservation things you guys are doing in conservation? What are the other things? I mean, this is a feather in the cap for sure. So it works both ways, and we appreciate what you guys are doing. And so you talked about the Missouri hunt. I know you like to hunt too. So you talked about the Missouri hunt. Rich, who's your videographer for the week. He's something else. Rich is something else. But
He's great.
And he said you guys had a great time. But it was tough, right? Hunting was tough.
It was tough. So I think, you know, the time that we were there, because, you know, when I left here in Oklahoma, the rut was, it was going pretty hard,
yep.
Right? So obviously we're south of Missouri, so that makes sense. And then when we got up there, I think we were catching the trailing end
for sure
of the rut, right?
Yeah.
So there wasn't as much movement. We were starting to see bucks back into, you know, bachelor groups,
yep,
and stuff like that. Amazing deer movement, amazing outfitter. I mean, all the controllables were in place, right?
Yeah.
You can't control when the rut starts and when it ends, right? It just is what it is. It's an amazing experience. And like I said, an amazing setup and outfitter and stuff. And I mean, Rich was awesome to have in, you know, both the deer stand and blinds and all the other stuff that we operated out of for that week. But was a great experience. You saw a ton of deer every time we were there, right? You just didn't see the right one.
Yeah,
see the right one.
I've been with Joe. We've shot lots of episodes there over the years. I've actually hunted there with him. You know, you have a chance to shoot a booner every time you sit on that ground. The great thing about hunting with those guys is they don't really change their stands. I mean, they're legendary locations where, you know, giant deer have been killed over the years. So, if you weren't seeing deer, it's because they just weren't, they weren't doing anything. And that's the unfortunate part. But, I am here in probably 2 weeks. I'm going to start. I also edit that whole TV series, so I will be editing that episode. So I'll be diving in. I've already looked at some of the footage, but I'll be diving into your story and Danya's story throughout the week there. So I'm looking forward to putting that story together.
Yeah, you know, and for me too, and I think this is true of most hunters, like when, you know, deer camp is more than just hunting, right?
Yeah, for sure.
It's the experience, it's the people, right? And all the people I got to hang out with. I mean, Aaron and Be Alive there with you guys and stuff like that. I mean, just amazing people, amazing guides. I mean, just laughing and cracking up every evening and having a good time and cheering each other on. And, you know, a couple of guys put down a couple of really nice bucks while we were there. So that was fun to see as well.
Yeah, for sure. For sure, man. I'm going to have actually Ryan from Winchester will be coming on the show, I think next week or the week after. We'll be chatting. So we'll probably talk a little bit about his buck there. So you guys also, you do hunts to raise money, right? There are some things that you guys do. Tell me some of the hunts, or maybe one of the more memorable hunts you've been on recently that was kind of raising some dollar for Folds of Honor.
Yeah, so the first person, I'll probably rewind just a little bit, then I promise I'll get right into that.
Yeah,
you know, so I took the Folds of Honor to this outdoor space about 3 years ago, right? And, you know, Winchester in the space was an early, you know, partner, but nobody was really building an outdoor fundraising space. Right. And I'm kind of the guy for that. That's my wheelhouse. And so I started going that direction, and we started getting big companies like, you know, Yeti, Sitka, and probably have, you know, 50 different brand partners, you know, in the outdoor space alone. But the one guy I always wanted to meet, and a guy who had followed for years, was Mike Waddell, right? And the Bone Collector team. I followed him back on, you know, Realtree road trips and all that other stuff. I won't get into the whole story, but I ended up, I won't go through all the detail, I mean, but I ended up getting introduced to a friend of Waddell's just by chance, right? Well, I don't believe in chance, right? This was providential, but
yeah.
So I'm, you know, at this golf event and I'm invited to come out and, you know, kind of do like some storytelling and stuff like that. And I'm sitting next to this guy and he's like, hey, you know, where are you from? We start talking about Georgia. And then I start talking about hunting. He goes, oh, he goes, I know a guy I've done business with, who's a pretty famous hunter. He goes, do you know a guy by the name Michael Waddell? And I'm like, shut up. Yeah. I'm like, seriously? He goes, yes. So he literally calls Waddy on speakerphone, right then. And we start talking and stuff. And he tells Waddy, he goes, hey man, he goes, I can't make this elk hunt at R&K Hunting Company in Utah. And he goes, I'm going to send Nick. And Waddy was like, come on. Mm-hmm. The hunt was in 2 days.
Yeah.
Oh, 2 days.
Yeah.
2 days. So I go home and man, I'm just like, I'd never been elk hunting in my entire life, man. It's just all whitetail. And so I'm just throwing stuff in a bag and going and everything. Anyways, long story short, Michael Waddell and the Bone Collector team have been a tremendous fundraising support for us. I mean, they've just an unbelievable human being. I was just with him at SHOT Show and stuff, cutting up with him, doing interviews and everything. Just an amazing, amazing human being. Another person in the space, and we've auctioned hunts with Waddy as well too. We took a sweepstakes winner with us this past year. Another person who's been amazing in the industry, two people are Janet Waller, with Skullbound Chronicles, and then Julie McQueen with Carbon TV. Then last year, the Mule Deer Foundation was kind enough to let me auction a hunt. And they were going to be hunting with Jan and Jules at R&K Hunting Company and stuff. And just this amazing guy won the auction. Okay. And so we spent elk camp with him and he got an amazing elk and stuff. Great. And we're actually doing the same thing this year.
That's awesome.
And stuff. And so, yeah, we've been auctioning off, you know, cow elk hunts where we've got a pronghorn antelope hunt up in Montana and stuff. So that has been really, really fun being able to do that.
Yeah, that's awesome. I mean, the outdoor industry is, it's been my life for 25 years. I graduated college. While I was in college, I was producing in the industry when it was growing. And, you know, Michael has turned into somebody who I know pretty well. He's actually come up here and turkey hunted with us. We shot a big television or a commercial campaign up here in Michigan. And he came up with all the boys for a week. And we killed a couple turkeys together on some of the local ground I grew up learning turkey hunt on. And again, he's one of those genuine guys, and there is no mistaking. There's not two guys. It's always Michael. And that's the great part about it. The people that know him really appreciate that. And he's the nicest guy in the industry. There's no question about it. So when you meet people like that, it makes the industry even more special. And I think you look back in the history of, and it's changed a lot in the last 25 years, but where it is now, it's a little more attainable for people. When I first got into it, it felt like it was, you know, on the other side of the world because there was such a barrier to entry. But now if you can create a story and shoot it and put it on YouTube and have an Instagram channel, I mean, you can create your own future in the industry. It's harder now, I think, honestly, because there's more competition. But yeah, it's when you get on a hunt, you really truly learn who people are. I think that defines character in people, is when you get into a hunting situation and you see how they handle certain things, adversity, success, all that stuff. And that reveals itself in hunting. And I think that's what's beautiful about sharing camp with people is you truly bond with people over hunting. And it is. It's not about the success. It's about the camp. It always is. It always is. I'm glad you're able to get the industry, the outdoor industry, as part of, you know, something you guys are joint hand in hand with, and I think it's a great place to be. And I'd love to work with you guys on something individually, giving hunts away. We just did gave a hunt away for Kiefer Brothers this last year in Missouri hunt, and it was super successful. We should talk about that for sure down the road, how we can help you guys.
Oh, would love that. Thank you very much for the offer. All in on that one, brother. Thank you. Thank you very much. And yes, and put an exclamation point behind everything you said about Wadi. I mean, just like what you see is what you get, man. Yep. And that is a huge compliment because he's an amazing human being. But he and his wife, Christy, and just have treated me like family.
Yeah, absolutely, man. They're great people. Great people. What are some of your goals for the future, Folds of Honor? What's a couple years down the road, 5 years down the road? I know it's to help as many families as possible, but is there anything new that you guys are looking to do?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. So, in fact, we are having these conversations right now. So what is 3 years down the road, 5 years down the road, 10 years down the road look like, right? The need's not going away. Okay, as long as we're serving the cause of freedom, as long as people need to dial 911, there's going to be a need for the Folds of Honor, right? I think, unfortunately for us, a lot of times, the over two decades of the global war on terrorism is in a lot of people's rearview mirror, not front of mind. But it is very much on these military families' minds, right? And we're just seeing right now, we haven't hit anywhere close to the peak of those kids who are going to be eligible, right? So the numbers are going to continue to go up. So what is the smartest thing that we can do as a nonprofit, okay? We need to be a household name, right? When people think of Folds of Honor, we want them to think of, this is the team that helps the families of military and first responders, okay? And not to be a household name for the sake of being a household name, but I tell you what, it makes it a whole lot easier to raise money when you can do that, right? Sure. And stuff. And so being able to partner again, like with this, just having this avenue, right, through the eyeballs that are going to be on this podcast, through your social media with Winchester, all that other stuff, the show that we filmed in Missouri last year, those are all a part of that process, right? So that's one. And then the second one is each and every year, keeping this plane an afterburner and raising as much money as we can to say yes to as many kids as we can. Okay. Yeah. But right now, the number of qualified applicants is going to outpace our ability to raise money. That is for sure. Okay. And I'm just being completely transparent about it. Yep. Yeah. We put 10,000 scholarships and $50 million out the door last year. Right. But there's also 7,000. Okay. That we weren't able to do that
for. Yeah.
All right. And we want to close that gap each and every year.
Amen, man. Thank you so much for what you do for the military families, for our country. In the future of Folds of Honor is so bright, and if Winchester can be a part of that, and we're going to continue to, be hand in arm with you guys, and thank you so much for taking the time to sit down and tell me your story, the Folds of Honor story, and a little bit about the future. Man, we're excited. We're excited for you guys, and we're glad to be a part of it, man.
Nah, I'm honored. It's not, if you'll be a part of it, you have to be a part of the future and stuff. Yeah. And I mean, that is for sure. And, hey, if anybody out there in your audience, like I said before, hey, if you're, military first responder family, go check us out, foldsofhonor.org. If something I said tug at your heartstrings and you feel the need to support us financially, go to foldsofhonor.org. Okay, become a wingman with us, right? And a wingman gives $13 a month. You may ask, hey, why that number 13? And that number 13 is significant for us because it takes exactly 13 folds to bring that flag to its iconic triangle shape of freedom, right? And a number that we are wildly passionate about, and a price point that pretty much everybody can get involved, right? Most of y'all probably spent more on coffee this morning than that.
Right.
And so get in the fight with us, $13 a month. We're unapologetic about what we do. We're about faith, family, and freedom. We're about sending these deserving kids to school. And we're going to be good stewards with your money. 91 cents of every dollar goes to support our scholarship programs. Okay. We are a top 1% rated charity, four-star on Charity Navigator, platinum rated on GuideStar. Money goes to the right place with us. But more importantly, you are going to be able to join us in letting these families know that you are not forgotten and that you're seen and that we're here with you and America does care.
Colonel Nick Nichols, President, Folds of Honor, thank you so much for taking the time today.
Thank you, brother. Thank you for having me on.
This portion of the Winchester Life Podcast has been brought to you by Winchester Pet. From the field to the front seat, the trusted name of Winchester has everything you need for the four-legged friend in your life. For all of your pet accessories, visit worldofwinchester.com. Walkers. For all your hearing protection needs, visit walkersgameear.com. The leader in hearing protection. Walkers. Folds of Honor. Providing educational scholarships to the spouses and children of fallen and disabled military service members. Honor their sacrifice. Educate their legacy. To learn more, visit foldsofhonor.com. And now, back to the show. So this week on our Ammo 101 segment, we have with us guest Ben Frank from Winchester. And we're going to talk a little bit about the latest and greatest from the world of Winchester ammunition. Ben, welcome to the show. What are we going to talk about today?
Well, thanks for having me. And you know what I'd really like to talk about is kind of a product that is really just core to Winchester. And a lot of people know it as that Winchester white box. So you're talking about range ammo, target and practice ammo.
So why is it important? Obviously, target and range, I mean, it's important to have ammunition that doesn't break the bank, right? I mean, that is key to training for anything, whether it's, you know, shotgun or pistol or whatever it might be. So what is the USA white box? What's the advantage of that?
Yeah, so the advantage to you kind of mentioned it there, is really how do we put more rounds in the hands of the shooters so they can practice, train, have fun at an affordable price? And that white box is really that. Typically, those are FMJs, so full metal jackets, and we're building those, and we have our plant situated to build those at a very high volume, fast, to really accommodate all those shooters out there that are in the market. Like, when you think about the last, I'll call it 5 or 6 years, right? There's been so many new shooters that have come into the fold, and a lot of times, one of the first things that they're shooting is a pistol. A lot of times that's a 9mm pistol. And over the last few years, us as well as others in the industry have really bolstered that capacity to build more 9mm, build more pistol rounds. So those folks who are coming in have product to go out and have fun and shoot and practice and get better at.
Yeah. Yeah. So one thing I notice is we've done a lot of shoots and, you know, a lot of content stuff, a lot of storytelling. We went to the Yackley family and, you know, Becky and the crew, they run a lot of ammunition through, and they have a home range where they set stuff up and basically try to simulate certain 3-gun shoots or, you know, whatever competition's coming up next for them. White box is, I remember them saying white box is very close to, you know, the stuff that they shoot even for competition. So talk to me a little bit about white box and competition ammo, and is it the same, or how's that all work?
I mean, it's definitely different. Like, whenever you're talking about competitive stuff, a lot of times maybe you're using flat nose bullets, or we're curtailing the design of the bullet around the end use and maybe trying to really hone in on the accuracy. And white box is very accurate. But a lot of times maybe we have other checks and balances that go into play on, say, match loads or something. Sure. Like that. But that's particularly on rifle type products. But really on white box, I mean, it's covering all of those things in terms of like all the different cartridges, calibers that one might be out there trying to shoot with. And another piece of that puzzle is like the Yackleys, they're big competitors, right? There's also a lot of people out there who just want to be proficient with a firearm. They want to be safe with it. They want to teach their family how to use it. And white box is a great way to do that without breaking the bank. So when if you're, you know, if it's a personal defense situation or you just want to make sure you understand how that firearm functions, white box is oftentimes people's go-to.
Right on. And where can you find it? Everywhere? Is it in stores? Is it pretty readily available?
Yeah, white box is one of those things that it's throughout the country, everywhere you go. Like I said, a lot of times that brand was called USA for us, but everyone colloquially just calls it white box because that design is so really kind of iconic for us now in that space. So those folks who are used to shooting FMJ rounds, FMJ and white box and Winchester really just go together. And again, anywhere you go, anywhere you find ammo, whether it's big retailers, small retailers, almost everywhere throughout the country is going to have Winchester white box on the shelf.
Right on. Well, thanks, Ben. Appreciate you taking time to stop by.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks.
The Winchester Life Podcast is brought to you by Winchester Ammunition, Winchester Repeating Arms, Winchester Safes, White Flyer Targets, Folds of Honor, Birchwood Casey, Walkers, Winchester Pet, and Winchester Optics. Hey, thanks so much for listening to this week's show. Please make sure you click the follow button on your podcast apps so you never miss a new episode. This episode was produced by Aaron Cox and Jason Gilbertson, engineered by Jason Freer, directed by Chad Andrus, written and edited by Jason Brown, with behind-the-scenes photography by Kelsey Myers. I'm Jason Brown, and you've been listening to the Winchester Life Podcast. See you next time.